Though he noted that Obama had made several statements on Iran, Mattis remarked, "Presidential speeches are not a policy." His draft strategy focused on confronting and not tolerating Iran's destabilizing actions through Hezbollah, the Quds Force operations, and their actions in Iraq to undermine the U.S. It was designed to reestablish U.S. military credibility. The second part was a long-term engagement plan to shape Iranian public opinion. With Mattis out the door, no one cared about his views on Iran. When he was nominated as secretary, there was a sudden run on the plan, and copies could not be made fast enough. The question was, did Mattis's appointment as Secretary of Defense in a hawkish Trump presidency mean a likely military conflict with Iran? At the suggestion of former Secretary of State James A. Baker III and former Defense Secretary Robert Gates, Trump met with Rex Tillerson, 64, the CEO of Exxon for the past decade. Trump was impressed with the native Texan's confidence. He had a big presence. Tillerson had spent 40 years at Exxon and was untainted by government experience. Here was a man who saw the world through the lens of deal-making and globe-trotting, a businessman who had negotiated oil contracts worldwide, including billions with Russia. Putin had awarded Tillerson the Russian Order of Friendship in 2013. In December, Trump thumbed his nose at the Washington political world but embraced the business establishment and named Tillerson as his Secretary of State, the top cabinet post. Trump told aides that Tillerson looked the part he would play on the world stage. "A very Trumpian-inspired pick," Kellyanne Conway said on television, promising big impact. Chapter 7. Jared Kushner invited Gary Cohn, the president of Goldman Sachs, to come talk to his father-in-law on November 30th about the economy. A meeting was arranged for Cohn at Trump Tower. Cohn was a legendary risk-taker at the premier investment banking firm. He had an ego and sureness to match Trump's. He was advised that Trump routinely kept meetings to 10 minutes. In Trump's office were Bannon, Priebus, Kushner, and Steve Mnuchin, also a former Goldman banker and hedge fund manager who had been Trump's chief fundraiser during the last 6 months of the campaign. Mnuchin had been rewarded with the cabinet post of Treasury Secretary, though the appointment had not yet been announced. "The American economy overall is in okay shape," Cohn told Trump, "but it was ready to experience a growth explosion if certain actions were taken. To achieve this, the economy needed tax reform and the removal of the shackles of overregulation." Cohn knew this was what Trump wanted to hear. Then the New York City Democrat told the president-elect something he did not want to hear. "We're a trade-based economy," he said. "Free, fair, and open trade was essential." Trump had campaigned against international trade deals. "Second, the United States is an immigration center to the world. We've got to continue to have open borders," Cohn said. The employment picture was so favorable that the United States would run out of workers soon. So, immigration had to continue. "We have many jobs in this country that Americans won't do." Next, Cohn repeated what everyone was saying. Interest rates were going to go up over the foreseeable future. "I agree," Trump said. "We should just go borrow a lot of money right now, hold it, and then sell it and make money." Cohn was astounded at Trump's lack of basic understanding. He tried to explain. "If you, as the federal government, borrow money through issuing bonds, you are increasing the U.S. deficit." "What do you mean?" Trump asked. "Just run the presses. Print money." "You don't get to do it that way," Cohn said. "We have huge deficits, and they matter. The government doesn't keep a balance sheet like that. If you want to do something that would be smart, and you actually do control this, I would add a 50-year and a 100-year bond from the U.S. Treasury." With interest rates going down in recent years, Treasury had brought the duration of bonds down to 10 years as much as possible. "That was the right thing to do," Cohn said. "With rates increasing, the insurance companies and the pensions will lend the government money for 50 years or 100 years, and you could probably do it at 3.75%. That would be really cheap money over the next 50 to 100 years. Wow, Trump said. That's a great idea. He turned to Mnuchin. Can we do that? Oh, sure, the designated Treasury Secretary said. We can absolutely do that. Do you agree with him? Trump asked. Yeah, I agree with him, Mnuchin said. You've been working for me 6 months, Trump said. Why the hell have you never talked to me about this? Why is he the first person to ever tell me that? There was nothing in the world that was then yielding 3.75% risk-free, Cohn said. There would be a run on these bonds and plenty of buyers. The 50-year corporate bond was selling all over the place. Investors wanted high, risk-free yield. Turning to the Federal Reserve, Cohn noted that the U.S. had had an effective zero interest rate for years. There was only one way to go. Interest rates would go up for two reasons. The economy was getting much stronger, and higher rates would tamp down inflation. So if I'm running the Fed, I'm going to raise rates, he said. Trump knew that presidents liked low rates to help the economy. He said, Well, I'm not going to choose you to run the Fed, ever. That's fine, Cohn said. It's the worst job in America. Turning to taxes, Cohn said, The 35% corporate tax rate has been great for my business for the last decade. We've been inverting companies to 10% tax jurisdictions, and they pay us enormous fees. He was speaking as a Goldman president. An inversion refers to relocating a corporation's legal home to a low-tax country such as Ireland or Bermuda in the form of a new parent company while retaining operations and management as a subsidiary in the higher-tax country. Goldman had facilitated dozens of companies' moves abroad. The company's leaders and boards had a responsibility to shareholders to maximize profits, and moving, inverting, dramatically raised earnings. Nearly all the drug makers and insurance companies had moved. Cohn bragged, Where else can I take a company doing X in business that does X tomorrow and has 20% more earnings just by changing their corporate headquarters? Arguing against Goldman's self-interest, Cohn added, We can't allow that to happen. We've got to get our corporate tax in line with the average, which is about 21-22%. Though there had been some restrictions imposed by Congress, there were ways to skirt the new laws. We can't allow companies to just keep inverting out of the United States. It's just bad. It's wrong for business. It's wrong for jobs. I'm talking against my business. We made a ton of money. Trump returned to printing money. We'll just borrow, he said, enamored with the idea of heading the federal government, which had the best credit rating in the world, so they could borrow at the lowest interest rate. Cohn didn't mention a report that had come out during the campaign, which said the Trump Organization's business credit score was a 19 out of 100, below the national average by 30 points, and that it had trouble borrowing money. You just can't print money, Cohn said. Why not? Why not? Congress had a debt ceiling which set a cap on how much money the federal government could borrow, and it was legally binding. It was clear that Trump did not understand the way the U.S. government debt cycle balance sheet worked. Inflation would probably be steady. Automation was coming, Cohn said. Artificial intelligence, machine learning, robotics. We'll manage the labor supply more efficiently now than we ever did in the history of mankind. So look, you're in the most precarious time in terms of job losses. We now can create labor with machines. If you're here 8 years, you're going to deal with the automation of the automobile and truck. About 25% of the U.S. population makes a living driving something. Think about that. What are you talking about? Trump asked. With the self-driving autonomous vehicle, millions of people are going to have to re-enter the workforce in different jobs. That would be a big change and possible large disruption. I want you to come work for me, Trump said. Doing what? Trump mentioned Deputy Secretary of Defense. First of all, I don't want to be deputy secretary of anything, Cohn said. How about director of national intelligence? Cohn indicated no. He was not sure what the job did. He later learned it entailed overseeing the CIA and all the other intelligence agencies. You trade commodities, Trump said. Why don't you think about being Secretary of Energy? No interest. Trump tried to convince Cohn to become director of the Office of Management and Budget. No. Cohn knew it was a horrible job. You know what? Trump said at the end of what had become an hour-long meeting. I hired the wrong guy for Treasury Secretary. You should be Treasury Secretary. You would be the best Treasury Secretary. Mnuchin, right there, didn't say a thing or show any reaction. Come back and tell me what you want, Trump said. You'd be great to have on the team. It'd be fantastic. 5 minutes later, while Cohn was still in the building, he saw television flash breaking news. President-elect Trump has selected Steve Mnuchin as Treasury Secretary. That's crazy, Jared said. Mnuchin just put that out. You freaked him out so badly in the meeting. Cohn did some homework and spoke with other former Goldman executives who had worked in government. Robert Rubin, who had been head of the White House National Economic Council, NEC, for Clinton, and later Secretary of the Treasury, said that if Cohn could get the director of the National Economic Council job with a pledge he would be the chief economic czar, then he should take it. Being there in the West Wing was an enormous advantage if he had an agreement with the president. Cohn's wife, Lisa, said he should do it because he owed the country a great deal. You're too slow, you're too fat, and too old to serve your country any other way. Cohn returned to see Trump and expressed his interest in the NEC job as long as any economic business ran through him. It was the equivalent portfolio in economic matters to the National Security Advisor in foreign policy. Of course, Trump said. It'll be however you want it to run. We're going to do such great things. Priebus, who was in the meeting, worried about the on-the-spot hires. He later said to Trump, We're going to hire the guy, a Democrat who voted for Hillary Clinton, to run our economic council? Why? Shouldn't we talk about this? I'm sure he's really smart. Shouldn't we have a conversation before we offer a job like this? Oh, Trump said. We don't need to talk about it. Besides, the job had been offered and accepted. He's going to be great. The day after Christmas 2016, I reached Michael Flynn, Trump's newly designated National Security Advisor, by telephone. He was on vacation in Florida visiting his grandchildren. Flynn, a controversial retired three-star general and intelligence specialist, had been by Trump's side during the campaign as foreign policy advisor. At the Republican National Convention, he enthusiastically led the crowds in "lock her up" chants about Hillary Clinton. He later apologized. Obama had removed Flynn from head of the Defense Intelligence Agency in 2014 for management failures. And after the campaign, Trump had ignored advice from Obama not to take Flynn as his national security advisor. I called Flynn to get his take on Russia. Several intelligence and Pentagon officials had told me that Russia had moved in recent years to modernize and improve their nuclear capability with a new submarine-launched ballistic missile and two new ICBMs. Yes, exactly, Flynn said on the record. Under Putin's direction in the last 7 or 8 years, he said, Russia had not outmatched the United States, but had outsmarted us. He said he had begun talking to Trump about the Russian buildup 18 months before in 2015 when they had first met. He said that they agreed that the United States had given up too much of its capability, training, readiness, and modernization. Putin, he said, had, in a systematic way, upgraded not only his nuclear forces, but his tactical, conventional, and special forces. If Russia became an adversary and we went toe-to-toe with them, we'd face the reality of Putin using innovation, technology, and sheer effort. Flynn then spoke openly about the possibility the United States might have to begin testing nuclear weapons. The last U.S. test had been in 1992. "We are going to have to decide if we test again," he said. The computer tests might not be sufficient, and it was important to see if the weapons worked. "My counsel to the boss, I said we are going to have to devote time, energy, and resources to this." He said Trump's plan was to talk and act tough, send a shot across the bow of Putin. He added, "We will be leaning on the Reagan playbook. Be aggressive and then negotiate. We have to make it clear at the same time that we'll deal with Russia. You can't just have one view of Russia." Flynn was being widely criticized for going to Russia to speak for $33,750 from the Russian state-owned television network in 2015. He said it was an opportunity, and he got to meet Putin. "Anyone would go," he said. Flynn did a question-and-answer session in Moscow. He made a standard plea for better U.S. relations to defeat ISIS, the importance of defining the enemy and not trying to just contain ISIS as Obama had done. Overall, on foreign policy, Flynn told me, "The president-elect is taking on this plate of shit throughout the world. The world is a mess. There's lots of cleaning up to do." Chapter 8. After the election, President Obama directed his intelligence chiefs to produce a definitive, highly classified report on Russian election interference with all the sources and details. It would be briefed to the Gang of Eight in Congress and to President-elect Trump. An unclassified, scaled-back version with the same conclusions but without identifying the sources would be made public before Obama left office on January 20th. Director of National Intelligence James Clapper, CIA Director John Brennan, FBI Director James Comey, and National Security Agency Director Mike Rogers met to work on talking points for the briefing to Trump. They knew he would see the report as challenging his win, casting doubt on the legitimacy of his election. They agreed they would have to speak with one voice. "This is our story and we're sticking to it," Clapper said, encouraging solidarity. Clapper would be the main briefer. It was essential they speak with confidence. Clearly, the briefing was going to stir the beast. Earlier in December, Brennan had called Clapper. He had received a copy of a 35-page dossier, a series of reports from former British MI6 senior officer Christopher Steele that detailed alleged efforts by Russia to interfere with and influence the presidential election, to cause chaos, damage Hillary Clinton, and help Trump. The dossier also contained salacious claims about Trump, Russian prostitutes, and golden showers. "You should read this," Brennan told Clapper. The FBI already had a top-secret counterintelligence investigation underway to see if there was any collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia. "This will add substantiation to what we are doing." It was not proof, but it seemed to be on the same trail. Clapper consulted with the FBI. How should we handle it with Trump? The FBI was familiar with the document. Steele had shared portions of the dossier with them, and on December 9th, Senator John McCain had shared a copy with FBI Director Comey. Andrew McCabe, the FBI deputy, was concerned. He thought if they failed to tell President-elect Trump about the dossier when they briefed him about the intelligence community report on Russia, it would make the FBI look as if they were back in the old days of J. Edgar Hoover, as if to say, "We have dirt on people and we're keeping it to ourselves." Comey agreed. The Hoover legacy still cast a shadow over the Bureau. Clapper wanted to make sure they developed a consistent tradecraft model as they merged their intelligence into one report. The FBI and CIA have different standards. The FBI conducts criminal investigations in addition to gathering intelligence. The Bureau tends to be more rigorous in their sourcing and verification. What began as a pure counterintelligence investigation might morph into a criminal investigation, with intelligence becoming evidence that must stand up in court. The CIA's mission is to gather intelligence and disseminate it to the White House and the rest of the federal government. It does not have to be as solid because normally it would not be used in a criminal trial. Just as the FBI was haunted by Hoover, the CIA had its own ghost. In the run-up to the 2003 invasion of Iraq, the CIA made a huge mistake. In part as a result of lies told by a key source, amazingly codenamed Curveball, who claimed he had worked in a mobile chemical weapons lab in Iraq, the CIA had concluded that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, WMD. The case had been a slam dunk, according to a presentation CIA Director George Tenet made to President George W. Bush. The alleged presence of WMD was the key justification for the Iraq invasion. No WMD were found, an acute embarrassment for the president and the CIA. Clapper knew that mistake hung over much of what the CIA did and analyzed. One agency procedure was to polygraph sources as often as possible. While passing a lie detector test would never be considered complete proof, passing was a good barometer of truthfulness. The sources that Steele used for his dossier had not been polygraphed, which made their information uncorroborated and potentially suspect. But Brennan said the information was in line with their own sources, in which he had great confidence. The dossier was in circulation among journalists, and Steele had given confidential, off-the-record interviews to reporters. It had not yet been published. On the second page it said, "According to Source D, where she/he had been present, Trump's perverted conduct in Moscow included hiring the presidential suite of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, where he knew President and Mrs. Obama, whom he hated, had stayed on one of their official trips to Russia, and defiling the bed where they had slept by employing a number of prostitutes to perform a golden showers urination show in front of him. The hotel was known to be under FSB control, with microphones and concealed cameras in all the main rooms to record anything they wanted to. This was designed to obtain compromat, compromising material, on him, according to the dossier. It was a spectacular allegation. There was no available indication who Source D might be. Since the FBI had the dossier, Comey said, he ought to present it to Trump after their core presentation of the intelligence community assessment. It would be an annex, virtually a footnote. The 35 pages were reduced to a 1 3/4 page summary that focused on the allegation of coordination between the Russians and the campaign. Trump's response to the growing chorus of news reports saying that the intelligence services had concluded Russia had interfered with the election was belligerence. On December 9th, Trump said those sounding alarm in the intelligence community were the same people that said Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. He later told Fox News, "They have no idea if it's Russia or China or somebody sitting in a bed someplace." He tweeted, "Unless you catch hackers in the act, it is very hard to determine who was doing the hacking. Why wasn't this brought up before the election?" On January 5th, the Senate Armed Services Committee held a hearing on Russian hacking. Clapper, who was to brief Trump the next day, testified. Angry at the criticism Trump was leveling at the intelligence community, he stated, "There's a difference between skepticism and disparagement. Public trust and confidence in the intelligence community is crucial, and I've received many expressions of concern from foreign counterparts about the disparagement of the U.S. intelligence community." The next day, Kellyanne Conway said on CBS This Morning, "Why would Russia want Donald Trump to win the presidency here? Donald Trump has promised to modernize our nuclear capability." In a telephone interview with the New York Times, Trump said, "This is a political witch hunt." Hope Hicks, 28, the public relations specialist who had been Trump's press secretary during the campaign, was situated in a small 14th-floor conference room in Trump Tower during the transition in early January 2017. She had two qualities important to Trump: loyalty and good looks. She had modeled as a teenager, and now, with perfectly made-up eyes and long brown hair swept back on one side, she had the polished and glamorous look Trump liked. She also had genuine public relations skills. Trump had asked her what job she wanted in the White House. Anxious to avoid the daily hand-to-hand combat with the press, she had picked Strategic Communications Director so she could manage his media opportunities, which were, of course, now endless. She'd been the gatekeeper to his interviews. Everyone wanted Trump, and she felt that he had lost some of his leverage with the media by being overexposed during the campaign. Exploiting those opportunities would now require careful calibration. As well as anyone, she knew that might be impossible with the president-elect. Hicks was convinced the media had oppositional defiance syndrome, which is a term from clinical psychology most often applied to rebellious children. Oppositional defiance syndrome is characterized by excessive anger against authority, vindictiveness, and temper tantrums. As far as she was concerned, that described the press. Hicks was already working on a response to the reports of Russian meddling in the election. The excessive news reporting on what she called the alleged hacking by Russia only made the United States look weak and Russia more influential than she thought possible. On January 6th, the intelligence chiefs came to Trump Tower. Comey met Trump for the first time. In his book, Comey offers a description, perhaps to demonstrate his keen eye. His suit jacket was open and his tie too long, as usual. His face appeared slightly orange, with bright white half-moons under his eyes, where I assumed he placed small tanning goggles, and impressively coiffed bright blonde hair, which upon close inspection looked to be all his. I remember wondering how long it must have taken him in the morning to get that done. As he extended his hand, I made a mental note to check its size. It was smaller than mine, but did not seem unusually so. In the Trump Tower briefing, Clapper summarized the key judgments, the heart of any intelligence assessment. Russia has had a long-standing desire to undermine the U.S.-led liberal democratic order, but in the 2016 presidential election there was a significant escalation in directness, level of activity, and scope of effort. Putin has ordered an influence campaign in 2016 aimed at the U.S. presidential election to undermine public faith in the U.S. democratic process, denigrate Secretary Clinton, and harm her electability and potential presidency. We further assess Putin and the Russian government developed a clear preference for President-elect Trump. When it appeared to Moscow that Secretary Clinton was likely to win the election, the Russian influence campaign began to focus more on undermining her future presidency. It was a mild formulation. Trump was a clear preference, and the effort was aimed very much at discrediting and undermining Clinton. There was no suggestion that Trump or his associates had colluded or coordinated with the Russian effort. All the sources fit together and told a consistent story from different vantages in the Kremlin, Clapper said. These human sources had been so-called legacy sources. They had been right in their intelligence and assessments over the years, and at least one source had provided reliable information going back a generation. What has not been previously reported? One source was in such jeopardy that the CIA wanted to exfiltrate that person from Russia to safety abroad or in the United States. The source refused to leave, apparently out of fear of repercussions against the person's family if the source suddenly left Russia or disappeared. Clapper did not give the source's names to Trump, though he could have asked for them. "I don't believe in human sources," Trump replied. "These are people who have sold their souls and sold out their country." He wasn't buying. "I don't trust human intelligence and these spies." This remark caused Brennan, whose CIA relied almost entirely on human sources, later to remark, "I guess I won't tell the employees about that." This has also not been previously reported. The CIA believed they had at least six human sources supporting this finding. One person with access to the full top-secret report later told me he believed that only two were solid. Trump asked if there was anything more. "Well, yes, there is some additional sensitive material," Clapper said. "Do you want us to stay, or do this alone?" Priebus asked Trump. Comey suggested, I was thinking the two of us. Just the two of us, Trump agreed. Though he could play the tough G-man, Comey somewhat soft-pedaled the summary he had. He explained that there was a dossier with allegations. He was passing it on. It was out there. He didn't want the president-elect to be blindsided because it was in wide circulation, and certainly it, or parts of it, would surface in the media. The dossier alleged that Trump had been with prostitutes in a Moscow hotel in 2013, and the Russians had filmed it. Comey did not mention the allegation in the dossier that Trump had prostitutes urinate on each other on the bed President Obama and Michelle Obama had once used. Comey later wrote, I figured that single detail was not necessary to put him on notice about the material. This whole thing was weird enough. As I spoke, I felt a strange out-of-body experience, as if I were watching myself speak to the new president about prostitutes in Russia. Trump denied the allegations. Did he seem like a guy who needed prostitutes? In a higher loyalty, Comey wrote, The FBI was not currently investigating him. This was literally true. We did not have a counterintelligence case file open on him. We really didn't care if he had cavorted with hookers in Moscow, so long as the Russians weren't trying to coerce him in some way. This is what Comey wrote about how he conveyed this message to Trump at the end of their private meeting. As he began to grow more defensive and the conversation teetered toward disaster, on instinct, I pulled the tool from my bag. We are not investigating you, sir. That seemed to quiet him. The private meeting lasted 5 minutes. Trump later told his attorney that he felt shaken down by Comey with the presentation about the alleged prostitutes in Moscow. I've got enough problems with Melania and girlfriends and all that. I don't need any more. I can't have Melania hearing about that. After the briefing, Trump released a statement calling the briefing constructive, but he was clearly unswayed by the impact. Attempts by Russia, China, other countries to interfere had had absolutely no effect on the outcome of the election, including the fact that there was no tampering whatsoever with voting machines. 4 days later, January 10th, BuzzFeed published the 35-page dossier online. This was when I read the document. On page 27, it said, Two knowledgeable St. Petersburg sources claim Republican candidate Trump has paid bribes and engaged in sexual activities there, but key witnesses silenced and evidence hard to obtain. It added, All direct witnesses to this recently had been silenced, i.e., bribed or coerced to disappear. It made clear there was apparently no path to seek verification. I was surprised, not at the allegations, which might be true, but that the intelligence chiefs, particularly the FBI director, would present any of this to Trump. The core of their presentation on January 6th had been the intelligence community's assessment on Russian election interference. It was a report they felt was one of the most important, well-documented, convincing assessments by the intelligence community in recent times. In Facts and Fears, Clapper called it a landmark product, among the most important ever produced by U.S. intelligence. The CIA, NSA, FBI, and the other intelligence agencies had invested heavily in the intelligence gathering. They had also taken a risk by putting so much sensitive information in one report that could leak or be described. And then, almost as an afterthought, Comey had introduced the dossier as if to say, by the way, here is this scurrilous, unverified, unsupported footnote with some of the ugliest allegations against you. They wanted the formal assessment to be believed by the president-elect. Why pollute it with the dossier summary? They knew enough about Trump to know it would rile him up. It likely would have riled anyone up. Why would they accompany some of their most serious work with this unverified dossier? The material in the dossier is the sort of stuff that a reporter or the FBI might more than reasonably follow up on, try to track down its origins, even locate some of the sources and see if any confirmation can be found. Clearly, the FBI had an obligation to make this effort, as they later would. But including it, even in scaled-down form, in one of the most important briefings the intelligence chiefs might ever present to a president-elect, made little sense to me. It would be as if I had reported and written one of the most serious, complex stories for the Washington Post that I had ever done, and then provided an appendix of unverified allegations. Oh, by the way, here is a to-do list for further reporting, and we're publishing it. In A Higher Loyalty, published a year later, Comey writes at length about his misgivings about how he was going to handle the dossier before he met with Trump. "I was staying on as FBI director," he wrote. "We knew the information, and the man had to be told. It made complete sense for me to do it. The plan was sensible, if the word applies in the context of talking with a new president about prostitutes in Moscow. Perhaps it may turn out to all be true, but imagine being told that by the FBI director." As Comey continued, "Still, the plan left me deeply uncomfortable. There was a real chance that Donald Trump, politician and hardball dealmaker, would assume I was dangling the prostitute thing over him to jam him, to gain leverage. He might well assume I was pulling a J. Edgar Hoover, because that's what Hoover would do in my shoes." An eyebrow raise didn't quite do this situation justice. It was really going to suck. On January 15th, 5 days before the inauguration, I appeared on Fox News Sunday. I said, "I've lived in this world for 45 years where you get things and people make allegations. That is a garbage document. It never should have been presented as part of an intelligence briefing. Trump's right to be upset about that." The intelligence officials, who are terrific and have done great work, made a mistake here, and when people make mistakes, they should apologize. I said the normal route for such information, as in past administrations, was passing it to the incoming White House counsel. Let the new president's lawyer handle the hot potato. Later that afternoon, Trump tweeted, "Thank you to Bob Woodward, who said, 'That is a garbage document. It never should have been presented. Trump's right to be upset, angry.'" I was not delighted to appear to have taken sides, but I felt strongly that such a document, even in an abbreviated form, really was garbage and should have been handled differently. The episode played a big role in launching Trump's war with the intelligence world, especially the FBI and Comey. Chapter 9. 5 days after taking the oath of office, January 25th, President Trump invited his top advisors and his national security team to the White House for dinner. Mattis, the new Secretary of Defense, presented Trump with plans for a SEAL Team 6 operation against a senior al-Qaeda collaborator in Yemen. He described how several dozen commandos would attack, hoping to capture intelligence, cell phones and laptop computers, and kill the collaborator, one of the few al-Qaeda leaders still alive. It would be the first operation in Yemen in 2 years. It had been considered and delayed by President Obama. The military wanted a moonless night for the attacks, and one was coming up. Bannon had questions about the larger problems in Yemen. The former Navy lieutenant commander wondered why the arms to the rebel Houthis could not be cut off and stopped by sea. Iran was their only ally. "You control the air," Bannon said. "You've got the U.S. Navy and you control the sea. How tough is it?" "It's a big coastline," Mattis replied. "Steve," Trump said impatiently, "these guys, this is what they do. Let them do it." In other words, shut up. Trump signed the order the next day, and the raid was carried out before dawn on Sunday, January 29th. A lot went wrong. During a 50-minute firefight, one SEAL was killed, three wounded. Civilians, including children, were killed. A $75 million Marine MV-22 Osprey made a hard landing, disabling the plane. It had to be destroyed to keep it from falling into the hands of the enemy. Chief Special Warfare Operator William Ryan Owens, 36, from Peoria, Illinois, was the first combat casualty in Trump's presidency. Trump decided to go to Dover, Delaware, to observe the ceremony for the arrival of his body. Ivanka accompanied him. When they arrived at Dover, the commander pulled the president aside. According to what Trump told his senior staff later, the commander said, "I want to prepare you for this, Mr. President. When you walk in, the family is going to come up to you. It will be an experience like no other. You're the commander-in-chief. The respect they show to you and their grieving will be incredible. You'll be there to comfort them. When the plane rolls up, when the flag-draped casket comes down, some of the family are going to lose it, and they will lose it very badly. On the other hand, be prepared to have some people say something inappropriate, even harsh." No one said anything harsh, but there was a definite coldness that the president remembered. "That's a hard one," he said afterward. He was clearly rattled. He let it be known he would make no more trips to Dover. Owens's father, Bill Owens, was at Dover, but he and his wife did not want to meet with Trump. "I'm sorry," Owens told the chaplain. "I don't want to meet the president. I don't want to make a scene about it, but my conscience won't let me talk to him." He later also said, "For 2 years prior, there were no boots on the ground in Yemen. Everything was missiles and drones, because that was not a target worth one American life. Now, all of a sudden, we had to make this grand display." Instead of striking out as Trump had done against the Khans, the Gold Star parents who had appeared at the Democratic convention in 2016, Trump expressed sympathy for Owens's father. "I can understand people saying that," Trump said later. "I'd feel, you know, what's worse? There's nothing worse." Several former Obama administration officials said the operation had been planned months earlier, but they distanced Obama from it, saying he had never approved it. In an interview on Fox the morning of his first joint address to Congress, Trump said the Yemen raid was something his very respected generals were looking at for a long time doing. "And they lost Ryan," he said. Trump invited Karen Owens, Ryan's widow and mother of three young children, to sit in the balcony at the joint address to Congress on February 28th. She sat next to Ivanka. To the congressional audience and 47 million television viewers, the president said, "We are blessed to be joined tonight by Karen Owens. Ryan died as he lived, a warrior and a hero, battling against terrorism and securing our nation." Because the operation was being criticized, Trump added, "I just spoke to General Mattis, who reconfirmed that, and I quote, Ryan was a part of a highly successful raid that generated large amounts of vital intelligence that will lead to many more victories in the future against our enemies. Ryan's legacy is etched into eternity." The president turned to Owens's widow in the balcony and said, "Thank you." Thunderous applause broke out. At first, Karen Owens fought back tears, exhaled, and mouthed, "I love you, baby." The applause continued, and tears began to stream down her face. She stood, joined her hands in apparent prayer, looked up, and mouthed, "I love you." Trump said, "For as the Bible teaches us, there is no greater act of love than to lay down one's life for one's friends. Ryan laid down his life for his friends, for his country, and for our freedom. We will never forget him." The applause and standing ovation from the Congress and the audience lasted nearly 2 minutes. "Ryan is looking down right now," Trump said. "You know that. And he is very happy because I think he just broke a record." Karen Owens smiled and clapped. The president greeted and embraced her in the hallway following the speech. Afterward, when Trump had phone calls with the families of others from the military who had been killed, the White House staff noticed how hard and tough it seemed for him. "He's not that guy," Bannon said. "He's never really been around the military. He's never been around military family. Never been around death." The deaths of parents of small kids struck him particularly hard. That had a big impact on him, and it's seen throughout everything. A staffer who sat in on several calls that Trump made to Gold Star families was struck with how much time and emotional energy Trump devoted to them. He had a copy of material from the deceased service member's personnel file. "I'm looking at his picture. Such a beautiful boy," Trump said in one call to family members. "Where did he grow up? Where did he go to school? Why did he join the service?" "I've got the record here," Trump said. "There are reports here that say how much he was loved. He was a great leader." Some in the Oval Office had copies of the service records. None of what Trump cited was there. He was just making it up. He knew what the families wanted to hear. Whether the international order would have a footing in the new Trump administration was tested in the first month. During the campaign, Trump disparaged the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, the 68-year-old alliance with Europe. NATO is often considered the most successful effort to counter the Soviet Union during the Cold War and a foundation of Western unity. The members pledged collective defense, meaning an attack on one would be considered an attack against all. Trump had argued that NATO might be obsolete. Much of his criticism had to do with money. NATO's goal was for each member nation eventually to spend 2% of its GDP on defense. The United States spent 3.5% of its GDP, while Germany spent only 1.2%. Secretary of Defense Mattis had a speech coming up in Munich, Germany in mid-February, and the administration's NATO policy needed to be settled by then. Was Trump in or out? As a private citizen, Mattis had blasted Trump's anti-NATO ideas as kooky. Much of the foreign policy establishment, as well as European allies, had been unnerved by Trump's comments. Priebus arranged a 6:30 p.m. dinner for Wednesday, February 8th in the Red Room of the residence so Trump could hear arguments from Mattis, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Joseph Dunford, and several others. He also invited a pillar of the Washington Republican establishment, C. Boyden Gray. Gray, 73, had most recently been the U.S. ambassador to the European Union for 2 years in the administration of President George W. Bush. He had been legal consigliere to George H.W. Bush during the 8 years Bush had been vice president and 4 years as president. As they sat down to dinner, Trump wanted to gossip about the news of the day. Senator John McCain, displaying his maverick credentials, had publicly criticized the U.S. military raid in Yemen. Trump lashed out, suggesting that McCain had taken the coward's way out of Vietnam as a prisoner of war. He said that, as a Navy pilot during the Vietnam War, McCain, whose father was Admiral John McCain, the Pacific commander, had been offered and taken early release, leaving other POWs behind. "No, Mr. President," Mattis said quickly. "I think you've got it reversed." McCain had turned down early release and been brutally tortured and held 5 years in the Hanoi Hilton. "Oh, okay," Trump said. Gray, who had served 5 years in the Marine Corps, was struck that the secretary corrected the president directly and that Trump, known to bristle when challenged, would be so accepting. It was not until the dessert course that Priebus finally said, "We've really got to deal with the NATO issue." Retired Lieutenant General Keith Kellogg, the National Security Council Chief of Staff, was representing the NSC. A combat veteran of Vietnam with Silver and Bronze Stars and the First Gulf War, Kellogg launched into a critique. Echoing some of Trump's negative language, he said NATO was obsolete and set up after World War II when the United States was richer and facing an aggressive Soviet Union. Now, the cost to the United States was unfair and out of proportion with European allies. The United States was being used. "Those wouldn't be my views, Mr. President," said General Joseph Dunford. "Oh, really?" Trump interjected. "What would your views be?" Dunford, the top military man, offered a spirited defense. "It's an alliance that shouldn't be disbanded, and it would be hard to put it back together," he said. With Eastern European nations such as Poland feeling threatened by Putin's invasions in Crimea and Eastern Ukraine, it was important to maintain solidarity and unity. It's terribly important to keep Europe united politically, strategically, and economically. He agreed that the member nations should meet their commitment to 2% of their annual GDP. I think the Germans will make good on their commitment to pay 2% of GDP, and they are the most important, Mattis added. Jared Kushner jumped in. As a percentage of our own defense budget, the shortfall is really small, he said. Pennies on the dollar. Priebus cautioned that the 2% was not an obligation, but a recent agreement that all the NATO countries would strive to get there by 2024. This was not a payment to NATO, but a commitment to defense spending. But it is a political problem when your allies don't pay their fair share, Trump said. He would make his case on fairness, and he kept returning to that theme. Why should the United States pay for the European defense? Priebus realized that the president didn't care that it was a goal, not an obligation. Trump cared that he could sell it and try to win over public opinion. I don't care if it's a goal or not, Trump finally said. It's what they should do. Boyden Gray pointed out that Europe had lots of economic problems. Not that we don't, but theirs are worse. The countries need to grow their economies more. Part of the reason they don't pay is because they're not growing fast enough. Are you saying they can't pay? Trump asked. No, Gray said. But the United States should help Europe with their anemic economic growth rate. European business culture largely avoided taking risks. Which is going to be the next country to drop out? Trump asked. Under the Brexit referendum approved by British voters, Great Britain had to leave the European Union. I don't think there will be another country to drop out, Gray replied. Trump said he agreed. If you didn't have NATO, you would have to invent it, Mattis said. There's no way Russia could win a war if they took on NATO. By the end of the dinner, Trump seemed to be persuaded. You can have your NATO, he told Mattis. The administration would support the alliance, but you become the rent collector. Mattis laughed, and then he nodded. In his speech in Munich on February 15th, Secretary Mattis found middle ground. America will meet its responsibilities, he said, but would moderate its commitment if the other NATO countries did not meet theirs. Nonetheless, he said the alliance was a fundamental bedrock of U.S. policy. At a news conference with the NATO Secretary General 2 months later, Trump said, I said it was obsolete. It is no longer obsolete. When Trump met the European leaders in May in Brussels, he castigated NATO countries for chronic underpayments. He said that 23 of the 28 member nations are still not paying what they should be paying and what they're supposed to be paying for their defense. He made it clear that he was addressing the United States domestic audience. This is not fair to the people and taxpayers of the United States. Chapter 10. What the hell, Priebus thought, as he scanned a February 9th story in the Washington Post reporting that National Security Advisor Michael Flynn had discussed sanctions against Russia with the Russian ambassador before Trump was in office. In one of his last acts as president, Obama had imposed sanctions on Russia on December 29th in retaliation for Russian meddling in the election. He expelled 35 suspected Russian spies and ordered the closure of 2 Russian-owned compounds in Maryland and New York believed to be involved in espionage. Priebus had asked Flynn many times about any discussions. Flynn had firmly denied discussing the sanctions with Ambassador Sergei Kislyak, the convivial man about town. 2 weeks earlier, on January 26th, Deputy Attorney General Sally Yates had come to the White House. She told White House counsel Donald McGahn that intercepts showed that Flynn had not been truthful about contacts with Russians and was worried that Flynn could be a blackmail target. Flynn had denied discussing the sanctions at least 10 times, Priebus calculated. The Post story, carrying the bylines of 3 of the paper's experienced intelligence and national security reporters, stated, 9 current and former officials were sources for their categorical assertion. Flynn had been interviewed by the reporters and had denied the allegations with a categorical no twice before backing away with a more fuzzy response. His spokesman was quoted. Flynn couldn't be certain that the topic never came up. Priebus tracked down White House counsel McGahn, 48, who was an expert on campaign finance law and had served 5 years as a Republican-appointed member of the Federal Election Commission. Priebus asked him if they could get the transcripts of the conversations that Flynn had with the Russian ambassador. Yes, McGahn said. Of course. Soon he had the highly classified transcripts of three communications between Flynn and Kislyak that the FBI had intercepted during the routine monitoring of the Russian ambassador. McGahn and Priebus were joined by Vice President Pence in the Situation Room to review the transcripts. Pence had backed Flynn's denial publicly. According to a 6-page internal White House counsel's office memo, Flynn said if he and Kislyak discussed sanctions, it was only because Kislyak brought it up. From the transcripts, Flynn had brought up the issue. McGahn and Priebus agree that Flynn has to be let go. In all three transcripts, Flynn and the ambassador discussed the sanctions. In the last call, initiated by Kislyak, the ambassador thanked Flynn for his advice on the sanctions and said the Russians would follow it. That nailed the story, and it explained Putin's curiously passive response to the sanctions. Normally, the Russian president would be expected to retaliate, expelling some Americans from Russia. But the day after Obama announced the sanctions, Putin announced he would not. President-elect Trump praised Putin, tweeting, "Great move on delay by V. Putin. I always knew he was very smart." The sequence suggested that Trump might have known of Flynn's role. But it was unclear what Flynn had said to the president about his conversations with Kislyak. Priebus told the president he would have to let Flynn go. Flynn's security clearance might be pulled. The embarrassment would be significant. Flynn's resignation was announced on February 13th. The chief reason offered publicly was that Flynn had lied to Vice President Pence. Trump told others in his administration that he let Flynn go because Flynn was not up to the job. The next 9 months were difficult for Flynn. He later pled guilty to one count of lying to the FBI. Flynn told associates that he didn't think he lied to the FBI when he was interviewed 4 days into the administration. The FBI agents had come to talk to him about matters other than Russia, and he had not believed it was a formal interview. Why did Flynn plead guilty? A range of possible offenses were being investigated, including his failure to report income from Turkey, report overseas contacts, and to register as a lobbyist prior to joining the Trump administration. Flynn told associates that his legal bills were astronomical, as were his son's, who was also being investigated. A one-count guilty plea for lying seemed the only way out. His statement said, "I accept full responsibility for my actions," and said he now had an agreement to cooperate. He denied that he had committed treason, an apparent denial that he had colluded with the Russians. On Saturday, February 25th, after 5 weeks in office, Mattis called a noon meeting at the Secretary of Defense's residence at the old Naval Observatory near the State Department. Attending were some foreign policy graybeards, retired General Anthony Zinni, several former ambassadors, and some Mattis staff. Mattis had almost no furniture. They all sat around what looked like a government-issued dining room table. Mattis said he had showed up with 4 suitcases. "You should see the skiff I have," he said. The Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility for securely discussing the most sensitive, top-secret, and special access programs was upstairs. "I never have to leave. I can do all the work from here." "President Trump is a good listener," Mattis said, "as long as you don't hit one of his third rails. Immigration and the press are the 2 big ones. If you hit one, he is liable to go off on a tangent and not come back for a long time. Secretaries of Defense don't always get to choose the president they work for." Everyone laughed. The subject of the meeting was the counter-ISIS plan that Trump wanted immediately. Fundamentally, Mattis said, we are doing things backwards. We are trying to devise a counter-ISIS strategy without any